Please take a seat. We're about to begin the program. First of all, good evening and thank you for coming. On behalf of myself, the members, board of directors, officers, and especially the committee for special events this evening, chaired by Dr. Shulman and by Ruth Stillman, and I'd like to thank them for having arranged this evening. And for myself, Avraham Hoshander, we thank you. First and foremost, I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce our rabbi. He's already pretty well known. We all know who he is, but nevertheless, he's still entitled to the introduction which he gets. I remember when he first arrived here at the shul, God knows how many years ago. I was still a kid when he first became part of Young Israel Bethel. It's way, way, way back. And at that time, they talked about him, and they said that he was up and coming. Well, I'd like you to know that he's still coming. He came, and he's up. Okay? He's up really high. He's not only the leader of the Rabbanut here in Borough Park and one of the leaders of the Jewish community here in Borough Park. On the contrary, he's much, much more. He's actually one of the leaders of the Jewish community now worldwide. So without further ado, I'd like to take this opportunity and this privilege to introduce Harav Moshe Snow, the Morod Asra of our shul.
That's why the world is in trouble, because I'm a leader. Shavua Tov, a good vach, everyone. Baruchim Aboyim, and welcome to another in our informative series of, well, the terminology that's used is scholars in residence, but that's just a fancy American term for the gift of having a Talmud Chacham, a Rosh Yeshiva with us, who graced our presence over the Shabbos and enlightened us on so many issues last evening. It's interesting, our shul has a privilege now. You know, during the week, so between men, I'll put in a plug for a few things for a minute here. First of all, there's a Daf Yomi every morning at 6:10 in the morning. Tomorrow morning at 7:40 in the morning. You're more than welcome to join that. But every day between Mincha and Ma'ariv, so we learn Mishnayos and Halacha every single day between Mincha and Ma'ariv, except once a week. Once a week we learn the Chofetz Chaim Shmiras Haloshon. So the Chofetz Chaim Heritage Foundation found out that we learn Shmiras Haloshon once a week over here, so they decided they want to send a crew down to videotape it for one of their programs. I don't know if you saw a few years ago on Tisha B'Av, so they had some footage of our shul. So one evening I'm sitting and learning Chofetz Chaim in between Mincha and Ma'ariv, and the Rosh Yeshiva Reb Shmuel Kamenetsky comes into the shul. So I immediately jumped up and I told the Balabatim, well, it's so privileged we have the Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva of Philadelphia, Reb Shmuel Kamenetsky here, and I said, maybe the Rosh Yeshiva would like to give the shiur. And he said, no, but please continue. He didn't, such an honor, he didn't want to even take a front seat. So we're graced. Now, not only did we have the Rosh Yeshiva Reb Shmuel Kamenetsky, but of course over this Shabbos, we had, of course, Reb Nosson Kamenetsky Shlita, both of whom are Brokara Da'avua. They are definitely symbols of the greatness of Rav Yaakov, and anyone who had the privilege of ever meeting Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Zichrono Levracha, knows that it was an encounter with someone who fulfilled the statement in the Gemara that if the person who teaches you is Dome Lemalacha Elikim. So I had that privilege at that time, and now we have the privilege of having Rav Nosson Kamenetsky with us, and I'd like to introduce to you our guest speaker for the evening on a topic which, as he himself said, causes some Agmas Nefesh, but you know, when a Gadol handles a topic that has to do with Agmas Nefesh, somehow it doesn't come across that way. That's the impression I've been getting. So we're going to have that privilege of listening to him tonight. It's my privilege to present Harav Agon Rav Nosson Kamenetsky Shlita.
I would like to welcome some of the people that came from a great distance to hear me tonight. And Lee Nedar, I'll try to make it worthwhile for you. Before speaking about the story of the ban on my book, Making of a Godot, I would like to say a few words about the title of my lecture tonight. The title was chosen by the Activities Committee, whose chairman, Dr. Shulman, emailed me to Jerusalem several weeks ago when it came to his attention that I would be visiting the United States at this time. And he wrote, "Would it be possible for you to be scholar in residence?" That's a term that the rabbi described as a special American term. "Scholar in residence in Bethel of Borah Park during your visit. The scholar in residence would consist of two talks, a Friday night talk on Reb Yaakov and the pre-World War II yeshiva world, and a talk on Motzei Shabbos on the making of a ban." This title that he chose is extremely interesting. You see, when the book that I wrote was banned, when the ban was issued 26 months ago, I was so upset and angry, I tried not to show it, as Rabbi Snow told you, that I felt I must channel my anger into something creative. And I'm going to let you in on something that has been a secret until now, and you can tell everyone you heard about it first in Young Israel, Bethel, and Borah Park. This is the first time I'm publicizing what you are going to see now. I channeled my anger into writing a book about the ban, and here it is. In its prologue, I write, "I had even intended to name this book Making of a Ban, to parallel the name of the book whose ban it is surveying. It is not called Making of a Ban, but Anatomy of a Ban. But in the introduction I write that I had thought that I should name the book Making of a Ban like Making of a Godot. But because the reader will come to the realization as he progresses through this book that the process of the ban's creation can best be summarily described as Kafkaesque, I decided that the name of the book deserves some surrealistic reference. I have therefore included a medical term in its title, which, when applied to a ban, brings the Frankenstein fable to mind. Thus, Anatomy of a Ban. Now, if the chairman of the committee, a medical doctor, would have had an inkling that such a book existed, he would have entitled tonight's talk not like the Hava Amina that I had of naming this book The Making of a Ban. He would have entitled the lecture Anatomy of a Ban. You're probably wondering why you did not see this book. It was printed back in 2003. Why didn't you see it in the bookstores? The reason is that it was published only in a limited printing for the historical record and was never sold. I have presented it only to members of my family and very close friends who were to keep it confidential. It is not for general distribution. Perhaps someday this book will become public, but probably not in my lifetime. If you are wondering for what purpose did I write a book that I will not publicize, I will read to you seven sentences from the prologue. I write, "Although I held that the ban should not have been issued, I did not want to fly in the face of the Gdolim, some of whom I respect very highly. The first signatory on the ban, Rabbi Yosef Shalom Eliashiv, may he have long life, it was his signature that brought the other signatories to follow suit, is a great posek whom I adore, nay, love, and I would not dream of disobeying him. I see him as a child sees his father, even if a son has been undeservedly slapped by his father, he still loves him. The reader may then ask, if your purpose is not to show anyone up, why have you written Anatomy of a Ban? Firstly, as a quasi-historian, I want posterity to know the story of how a ban on a good book, and those who read Making of a God, they'll know it is a good book, how a ban came about. Secondly, like every author, I wish to bring enjoyment to the reading public. Thirdly, by way of this book, I hope to clear my name in the eyes of the fair readers whose opinion counts with me, of the accusation implicit in the ban that I am an evil person. May the Almighty spare us. Now, let me tell you something of issuance of bans. You shouldn't think there's a special legal process by which a ban comes about. Don't picture it like a congressional committee or a sitting of the Knesset or even a meeting of the board of a synagogue. That's not the way it goes. It's usually some zealot who feels that for the good of Klal Yisrael a certain thing should be banned, and he writes up a letter and he takes it into the Gadol. The Gadol evaluates it. He may correct a word or two, and then he signs the letter. Once this letter has been signed, this zealot, or perhaps it's two or three zealots, take this letter, the signed letter, around to some other Gdolim, who countersign what the main Gadol has written, has signed. But it's not a ban yet, it's only a letter. The next step, this is the second step in the issuance of a ban, is that this letter is published in the newspaper, usually on the front page, because what can be more interesting to the reader than a new ban? On the front page of the paper, this letter is printed up, and in that way, it changes from a letter to an epistle. It becomes an official ban. On our topic tonight, let me first discuss who made the Isser on my book. I mentioned it already when I was quoting from my Anatomy of a Ban. I live in Eretz Israel since 1968, 37 years. That's exactly half of my entire life have I lived in Jerusalem, Baruch Hashem. And my Rabbanim and Poskim are the Israeli Gdolim. Without due honor to the American signatories on the ban, I believe that they too made the ban only as a result of the ban already having been issued by the great Israeli Posek, Rav Eliashiv. If I am wrong, and the Americans made the ban on their own, I dare say that if they are Gdolim, so am I a Gadol, in all humility. If they say the book is bad, And I say the book is excellent. I'm not beholden to them, but I am beholden to Rav Eliashiv, the Posek Hador. In fact, one American Rosh Hashiva, who I think is greater than all these American signatories, he wrote a letter to Rav Eliashiv, and I quote, "Lefi dati she'ein shum hatzaka le'esor ha'sefer hanal." There is no justification whatsoever, and he underlined it, to ban the book, end quote. So, I am not the only American Gadol who considers the book kosher. A real American Gadol, Rav Zelig Epstein, also considers it kosher. But Rav Eliashiv issued a ban. Let me speak about another Israeli Gadol, Rav Moshe Sternbuch, author of Moadim Uzmanim, who, because he was raised in England, knows English. Unlike Rav Eliashiv or all the other Israeli signatories, I'll soon discuss that, if all of them do not know English, but certainly Rav Eliashiv doesn't know English. Rav Moshe Sternbuch, he's part of the Edo Acharedis, he's a dayan in the Edo Acharedis. He knows English, and he read my book more than once, and he rules for anyone who asks him that my book is kosher. In fact, I davened in his shul in the Har Nof section of Jerusalem several months ago, and after davening, as I'm walking toward him to bid him good Shabbos, he shouts out with an earshot of at least 50 people, "Reb Nosson, you keep writing. No one can do as good a job as you." So far, insofar as Gedolim, who read my book, but Rav Eliashiv, my Gadol, who did not read my book, he knows no English, he signed the letter against the book, and after he had signed it, my detractors went around to five other Gedolim, who also cannot read English, and got them to countersign Rav Eliashiv's letter. Remember, this is only a letter. It's not a ban yet. A month later, when these six Gdolim and others convened to decide on who should run on the Yadus HaTorah party slate for the election of the Knesset, when they got together, my detractors got four more signatures against the book. Everyone was there. Everyone sees this letter, signed by Rav Eliashiv. By this time, it's signed by five other great men. And four more who were sitting there discussing the Knesset elections, they signed too. Making a total of 10. A million of great men against a little trefa book. Let me add, parenthetically, that one of the 10, not one of the original six, one of the 10 does read English. He is Rabbi Scheinberg. But I asked his son, Reb Simcha Scheinberg, whether his father read my book. And he replied, "My father did not read your book. He never even read All for the Boss." The book, written by his wife's sister, Rakoma Shane, about the Herman family, which also speaks about this American-born Rabbi Scheinberg and the years he spent in Yeshiva Tzmir in Europe. And he never read that either. He signed the ban for the same reason that the others who can't read English signed the ban. Rav Eliashiv signed it. So nine great men countersigned Rav Eliashiv's signature that my book is so objectionable, that is a Freudian slip, that my book is so objectionable that la yavol b'kehal Hashem, like a mamzer, it must not enter the congregation of God. Since the demise of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Rav Yashiv is considered the posek of the generation, the posek hador. I knew both of these gdolim. Let me say several words about Rav Yashiv's predecessor, Rav Auerbach. I was one of the last people to speak to Rav Shlomo Zalman before he died. I went to his house to ask him about his psak concerning and forbidding the use of the crock pot on Shabbos. Perhaps people are unaware that he forbade it. Dr. Shulman? Is Dr. Shulman here? Dr. Shulman, I need some medical help. A glass of water. I was one of the last people to speak to Rav Shlomo Zalman before he died, and I told him that in America everyone has been using the crock pot for many years for putting up the chont, and the poskim in America approve it. So listen to his response, because it reflects his character. He said, "But what can I do? This is what my mind dictates. I can only pasken by what my mind dictates." He said it with such humility and truth, as if he apologizes that his mind works in the way that it does, and he therefore had no choice but to pasken that it's osur, even if he'd like to go along with the American poskim. Because of his humility, he was so accessible, so easy to speak to both young and old, great and small. Let me in passing tell you about a visit to his poor home in Shaarei Chesed 25 years ago in 1980, when I accompanied my father visiting Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Reb Shlomo Zalman told my father a certain Meiri, which my father was unaware, had been unaware of. You have probably all heard of the Gemara in Pesachim, that Tevava Medbeis, which says, "Kol ma she'omer locha balabais asei, chutz mitzei." Everything that the balabais tells you to do, you must do, except when he orders you to leave. Chutz mitzei, those two words. Now, there are some texts of Gemara which don't have these two words in it. But some of the texts of Gemara do have chutz mitzei. You have to listen to the Baal Bais and everything, except when he orders you to leave. But does it make sense? If you are visiting someone and he tells you to leave, you don't have to listen to him? The Mashal raises this problem by asking, how can a person remain in someone else's house against his will? The poskim discuss these two problematic words in Orach Chaim Simen Kuf Ayin. There are some editions in Shas which don't have it, but the Meiri had it in one of the editions that he used. So Rav Shlomo Zalman told my father something that he hadn't known. The Meiri says that the two words chutz mitzei are to be stricken out of the text, like those other editions of Shas, which don't have the two words. But he adds an interesting statement. V'derech hagoas leitzim nishtav shubo. In the manner of an emendation of jokers did the textual error come about. He discusses these two words, and he says, in a manner of an emendation of jokers. I want you to remember these two words. My father and Rav Shlomo Zalman met only several times during my father's visits to Eretz Yisrael, but their hearts harmonized to an incredible degree. When my father passed away, I was naturally in Eretz Yisrael, and I asked Reb Shlomo Zalman whether I should sit Shiva in my home in Jerusalem or join my siblings sitting Shiva in Flatbush. He told me to remain in Jerusalem, saying there must be a place in Eretz Yisrael for people to be able to go and be Menachem Avel. And I sat Shiva in Jerusalem. All the Gdolim came to comfort me, including Reb Shlomo Zalman and Rav Shach and Rav Elyashiv. Let me tell you that Rav Elyashiv, may he have long life, is of a different character than Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Zichrono Levracha. This is a point which my book, Making of a Gadol, brings out, that not all Gdolim are created of the same cloth. Each one is an individual. They're all great men, but each one has his uniqueness. Each one is different than the other. As Rav Shlomo Zalman was different from Rav Elyashiv. If you've seen pictures of the two Gdolim, you will find that Rav Shlomo Zalman is smiling, like my father in his pictures, always with a smile. And Rav Elyashiv always looks earnest, even stern. Insofar as accessibility, even as Rav Shlomo Zalman was extraordinarily accessible, Rav Elyashiv is extremely inaccessible. It takes all type of maneuvering to get to see him. The difference between these two Gdolim was brought out poignantly when I received a call from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Rosh Yeshiva of Har Etzion Yeshiva, Rav Lichtenstein called me up soon after the ban was issued. He's only a passing acquaintance of mine, but he was very close to Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. And he said, if Rav Shlomo Zalman were alive, this issur would not have been issued, because he was so much more considerate of people's feelings. I thanked Rav Lichtenstein for his kindness in calling to comfort and encourage me, but I added, you knew Rav Shlomo Zalman, but you didn't know Rav Shach. I knew Rav Shach too. And I tell you that had Rav Shach been alive, the issur would also not have been issued, for a simple reason, that Rav Shach would have called me in to speak to me, whereas Rav Elyashiv did not speak to me at all. I'll read to you the initial words of Rav Elyashiv's banning letter. It says, Nizdazanu Lishmoa. This is not the letter. I'll explain what this form is. The letter was a simple letter, but this is the text of the letter. This is already the ban. We were shaken up to hear Mipi Talmidei Chachomim Ne'amonim, from the mouth of reliable Torah scholars. That a certain book is such and such, etc., etc. Rav Elyashiv did not speak to me. He only heard from these reliable Torah scholars. And what did he hear from them? That a book, this is the word used in the letter he signed, not a book, but a book, by the name of Making of a Gadol, is being distributed, and I'll quote, it is full of debasement, humiliation, and defamation of some of our great holy teachers, luminaries of Israel. Therefore, this book is forbidden to enter the congregation of God. both to keep it at home and to read it and to sell it. I know of someone who obeyed this ban by actually burning the book. He was the one who had whipped up the opposition to the book to begin with. He was that zealot who came in to Rav Eliashiv to report on this terrible book that's in existence. And what was bothering him? He did not want to reveal that Rav Aaron Kotler read Russian books in his early youth, as did my father. The book writes that about my father and about Rav Kotler. And if anyone, Chas V'Shalom, would accuse me of trying to say something wrong about Rav Kotler, they could say I was trying to say something wrong about my own father, if I had considered it wrong. But I didn't consider it wrong. Why didn't I consider it wrong? Because this is the making of a gadol. This is the way these gadolim grew, and this is the way these are the tests that they had to overcome. They were learning in a yeshiva in Minsk, where there was no mashgiach to tell them what yes to read, what not to read. And they were verily in danger of being sidetracked from Torah. These were the times. Anyways, this individual did not like that this was written. And I'd like to add that my father mentioned this in public many times. I didn't hear Reb Aaron much, but I wouldn't be surprised if he also spoke about it publicly very much. But this young man, who is a grandson of Rav Kotler, he did not know Rav Kotler well, because he was a youngster when Rav Kotler passed away. So he thought revealing such a thing is taboo. Incidentally, I was a Rebbe of this young man, this grandson of Rav Kotler. And Rav Kotler once told my father that he's very grateful to me. Why? Because when I was teaching this young man, I opened his head to learning. This is what Rav Aaron said. Er geöffnet mein inneres Kopf zu verstehen lernen. But of course, we live in the times of Ikvasa de Meshicha, when, like the Gemara says, children rise up in the face of the parents, and I'll let Talmidim rise up in the face of the Rebbeim. But I don't rise up in the face of Rav Eliashiv. I obey the ban. I'll speak about it at greater length. So he didn't like what it said in the book, and he wanted people to think that Rav Aaron Kotler was a Kodosh Meirechem, he was holy from the moon, and this is the individual who actually burned my book. Let me say immediately that I do not know what these reliable Torah scholars reported that my book writes. I was not there when they spoke to him. But I know they are definitely not reliable Torah scholars, because I know of two lies that they told Rav Eliashiv. I was in Los Angeles when the letter was written up by these people, and Rav Eliashiv signed. It was written on Rosh Chodesh, that's the date on the letter, Rosh Chodesh Kislev, Tavshin Samach Gimel. And I got wind of it across the world. My son asked one of the three people, he went with another two people, who had gone into Rav Eliashiv and had brought for his signature the letter that he signed, the letter that they had composed. He asked one of them why Rav Eliashiv did not call me in to speak to me before signing their letter. As I said, Rav Shach surely would have done. And so they answered, we suggested to Rav Eliashiv that he call him Rav Nosson. But Rav Eliashiv said, no, I won't call him in, because Rav Nosson won't come anyway. The next day, my son met Rav Efrati. Rav Efrati is Rav Eliashiv's aide-de-camp. And he asked him, why Rav Eliashiv said such a thing about me, that if he called me in, I wouldn't come. Rav Efrati responded, Chas v'shalom, the Rav would say such a thing. When Rav Eliashiv suggested to them that I be called in, they said they had already spoken to Rav Nosson, and he refused to budge. No one had spoken to me. So whom should I believe? What these zealots said? That Rav Eliashiv is the one who said not to call me in? Or what Rabbi Efrati said? He's a great Talmud Chacham who runs a network of Kolalim for the study of the halachas pertaining to Trumos and Maisles, all the halachas pertaining to Eretz Yisrael. And he may someday become the Rav of Yerushalayim to succeed the late Rav Yitzchak Kulitz. Whom should I believe? Especially when what the zealots reported about Rav Eliashiv is utterly ridiculous. And what Rav Efrati reported makes perfect sense. Why should Rav Eliashiv, who did not know me until this imbroglio, why should he say that I wouldn't appear before him if he called me in? So that is one lie by which I caught the zealots. Then there was another lie, which came to my attention just 5 weeks ago, when I paid a visit to Rav Eliashiv. You see, paradoxically, after the issuance of the Issur 2 years ago, I became personally acquainted with Rav Eliashiv. And I have visited him many times since then. 5 weeks ago, I brought up to him one of the early events in the story of the Ben. Let me give you the details. The above-described letter was signed on a Tuesday, Rosh Chodesh Kislev. And then it was countersigned a few days later. As I said, I was in California. 3 days later, on Friday, I found out about the letter. And I immediately faxed the letter to Rav Eliashiv. I faxed it to my son, and he brought it into Rav Eliashiv. On Motzoi Shabbos, following a proper salutation, it's three paragraphs pointed out in a very gentle and respectful way that the Rav seems to have broken the rules of judicial procedure. I'll translate the three paragraphs into English. The first one reads, I traveled to the United States for health purposes, and there it became known to me that the Honorable Torah Sage, Kvot Tarasa, you speak it about the Gadol in third person, the Honorable Torah Sage wrote a letter against the English book I published. I am sorry that the Honorable Torah Sage heard about what is written therein from a translator without hearing from the author himself what it writes. Now the second paragraph reads, from the time of the book's publication on Erev Rosh Hashanah until the time I left Israel 6 weeks later to take care of my health in the United States, I heard only praise for it. Had I suspected that in my absence its opponents would begin carrying on behind my back and involving Torah Gdolim, Torah greats, I would have stayed in Israel despite my health problems. So that his quote to Russell, so that his honorable the honorable Torah sage could have heard out both sides of the argument at once. This is the second paragraph. The third paragraph, in any case, by the way, when Rabbi Yasha read this paragraph, he realized they had lied to him when they told him they had spoken to me and I refused to budge. Because in the letter I wrote that until I left America, I only heard praise about the book. And I wouldn't have left had I known there was going to be any kind of discussion about it. The third paragraph reads, in any case, my present request is that the Honorable Torah Sage make sure his letter not be made public until I am given the opportunity to discuss before him what the book writes in its foreign language. Understandably, let this simultaneously sit before him the one who translated the book, before the Honorable Torah Sage in a way that aroused the Honorable Torah Sage's opposition. And then the Honorable Torah Sage will decide between us. If it is the Honorable Torah Sage's wish, I shall abort my American stay despite the resulting hardships to my health and come right back to Israel. This was the third paragraph in my letter to Rav Yashiv. Rav Yashiv read this letter on Motzoi Shabbos, November the 9th, while my son was present in his house. He had brought the letter and he read the letter. The great sage must have been impressed by the validity of my arguments, and he decided, contrary to the custom of publishing in Yated Ne'eman, a letter already signed by the sages of Israel. As I explained earlier, after the letter is signed, it becomes published and then it becomes an official ban. But he decided against publishing it. He decided not to do so. Thus, the signed letter would have not turned into an epistle and would have been relegated to remain a private, unofficial letter. I don't know if the Honorable Rav had intended, after he read my letter, to let the matter die a quiet death, or, as is more likely, he intended to call me back to Israel, as I had offered, so that he can get from its author a truer and a halachically correct picture of what the book was like. Unlike what the purported reliable Torah scholars described to him. And the entire story could have ended on a civil note, except that a new element came into play. This was Saturday night. On Monday, the streets of the religious neighborhoods of Jerusalem were plastered up with enlarged reproductions of the letter of denunciation. This is small form, it was big, pasted up in the streets. And those of you who know Yerushalayim are aware that the custom in our holy city is that the method of informing the public about things that are going on is to paste up posters in the streets. When the letter was not returned, see, they had taken the letter to get more signatures on it. That Rav Yashiv approved. That Rav Yashiv approved. But instead of returning it to him, they had blown it up at the printers and pasted it up in the streets. When Rav Yashiv was told what had been done, he was furious. And this was his reaction. I'm quoting from what his Talmidim told me. Amaisa Nevala, an act of outrage. They stole the letter from me. He announced this to his daily study group and to others in his neighborhood, that the posters had been put up without his permission. But once the letter was out on the streets, it was too late to subdue its message. It wasn't an official ban yet. It was only a letter, but this was its message. To Rabbi Eliashiv's consternation and to my embarrassment, the streets were abuzz with what the Torah greats of Israel wanted to keep under wraps, at least until further investigation. And immediately Rav Eliashiv began negotiations with me. At his request, I agreed to stop selling the book
until certain specified Torah grades who read English would peruse the book and decide if there were I also agreed to ask people who own the book already to kindly refrain from reading it until the committee had decided on its kashrus. So on a Sunday edition of Yeted Ne'eman, on November 24th, a prominent two-column ad was printed, and this is what it reads in translation. Tuesday, the 7th of Kislev, Los Angeles. I was still in Los Angeles. Since there are complaints about things I have cited in my book, Making of a Gadol, I have agreed that Torah greats who read English, who have been designated by name, and with Rav Yosef Shalom Eliash's approval, will read the book, and anything they hold should be changed therein, I will change. I have given an order not to distribute any more books, and I ask all who already have the book in their possession to kindly refrain from reading it until the matter is clarified. Now you will surely ask, why did I, the author who held that everything in the book is kosher, why did I agree to insert such an announcement in the Yeshivisha paper in Yeted Ne'eman? I will tell you. Because this announcement, which I sent into Rav Eliashiv to print, he controls the newspaper, was accompanied by a letter of mine to the Rav, which reads, I have received a copy of what the Honorable Torah Sage asked that I publish in Yeted Ne'eman. It is self-understood that my agreeing to limiting myself and distributing the book, all of which I hold, only increases pure Torah knowledge, comes about only because I do not want the greats of Israel, who have only heard from others what the contents of the book are, to come out against it with an official letter, meaning with a ban. Thus, by accepting my newspaper announcement, Rav Eliashiv agreed not to print his letter against the book in the newspaper, meaning he agreed not to issue a ban on the book, but to rely on my promise not to sell any more books unless and until it will be approved by the appointed reading committee. In fact, Rav Eliashiv told my son explicitly that if I agreed to insert the announcement in the newspaper, he would not issue an issue. Yet, 3 weeks later, 3 weeks of time, when books were no longer being sold, and I had already returned to Israel, I was stabbed in the back, and the letter of Rav Eliashiv, with all his countersignatures, was printed on the front page of Yeted Ne'eman. Here's the way it looked. This is the newspaper, and this in the upper left-hand corner was this letter with the 10 signatures. Rav Eliashiv first, and the others following. What happened? Rav Eliashiv decided to circumvent the three rabbanim appointed with his approval to pass judgment on my book, and he issued a ban. Thereby, Rav Eliashiv broke his word. It is, of course, not easy to raise such an accusation against the Posek Hador, Rav Eliashiv. But finally, 5 weeks ago, I'm sitting across the desk from Rav Eliashiv, and I took courage And I said to him, the Rav was not Omed B'diburo. He didn't keep his word. He had said that he would not come out with an Isser if I inserted the announcement in Yated Ne'eman. Don't forget, this is 2 years after that whole event happened. But I brought it up. After I put that announcement, and I showed him the copy of the newspaper as I showed you a minute ago, and the Rav said he would not publish, he would not come out with an Isser. And yet the Rav did publish an Isser. And he replied, you had written in the newspaper that you would sell no more books. And you did. So I protested. I said I did not sell any more books. I never told him that by that time when he asked me not to sell any more books, there were no more books to sell. Because in those 6 weeks, all my 1,000 book printing, it was all sold out. I had ordered my printer to print another 1,000, but then the tumult started, so I called him up. It was 2 weeks after I said print, and I said, do it fast because there's an interest in the book. So I said, did you spend money on it? Did you start printing? So he says, no, I didn't. So I said, God was with me, that you didn't start printing yet. Anyways, there were no books. And I did not sell any more books. So I told Rav Yashiv, it's not true. I did not sell any more books. And so Rav Yashiv replied, now listen very carefully. He replied, I have no Ruach HaKodesh. I was told that you were continuing to sell books. So besides the lie, they told Rav Yashiv that they had spoken to me before coming to complain to him, and that I had refused to budge. The Zhulikes, the Zealots, told Rav Yashiv another lie. They said that I was selling books after I had committed myself not to do so. So the reliable Torah scholars who caused the posek to be shaken, these dazanu, to hear that a book which does so and so is being distributed, etc., turn out, unfortunately, to be totally unreliable Torah scholars. You know, in the not distant past, there was another ban that Rav Yashiv issued on the basis of a reliable Torah scholar. I refer to the Isur on Shekels, which Rav Yashiv promulgated. He was not in India to see that the hair used for shekels comes from idol worship, Avodah Zarah. He listened to a report by a reliable Torah scholar. I hope that scholar was more reliable than the Zhulikas who fabricated stories about me and my book, for the simple reason that my book is a private affair, causing only me aggravation and monetary loss, whereas the ban on the shekels, based on a reliable Torah scholar, had caused a monetary loss of millions of dollars to countless Jewish women. I mentioned that the book of my ban caused someone to burn my book. It was Heinrich Heine, a German Jewish poet who lived at the beginning of the 19th century, who once said that people who burn books will eventually burn people. But I say that's only true among Goyim. Among Jews, Lahavdil, people who burn books will eventually burn shekels. Whether the unreliable Torah scholars lied or did not lie, the essence of the complaint on making of a gadol was that they read into it, to use the words of the denunciatory letter and the ban that they had composed on behalf of Rav Yashiv, they read into making of a gadol severe degradation, debasement, humiliation, and defamation of Gedolei Yisrael who lived 100 years ago. Before I delve deeper into this point and try to understand what was bothering them, let me point out that in recent years, prior to the ban on my book, there were problems with two other books. In fact, when the problem with my book was brought before Rav Eliashiv, he remarked annoyedly, "What is this lately with books? A book in America was banned, and a book in England was banned. Now there's a problematic book in Eretz Yisrael." The earlier banned books he was referring to were a book by the chief rabbi of England, Jonathan Sacks, titled The Dignity of Difference, and a book by Emil Hirsch and Yosef Reinman, titled One People, Two Worlds. The problem with those two books was heresy. Rabbi Sacks's book, Seeking Universal Tolerance, implied, some might say even indicated, equality between Torah and non-Jewish faith. Heresy. And Rabbi Reinman's co-authored book implied, by having an Orthodox rabbi polemicizing with a Reform leader, it implied parity among the so-called streams of Judaism, also heresy. But what was the problem with my book? There's a quarterly Hebrew magazine in Israel called Hamayan, which was once an organ of the now defunct Parale Agudas Israel political party. It sits somewhere between Agudat Israel and Mizrahi. In its winter 5,764 issue, that's last winter, it printed a book review of Making of a Godel by Professor Menachem Breuer, a grandchild of Reb Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, who is a distinguished professor of history in Bar-Ilan University. He begins his review by stating, I'll translate the Hebrew into English, as follows. The traditional Haredi bookcase has undergone a drastic change. For, besides the beautiful new editions of the classic Shas and Poskim, its contents now include books about the lives of sages, Rabbanim and Rashi Yeshivas. This branch of literature first sprouted among Hasidim, where it became known as Shivchei Tzadikim, the praise of Tzadikim. And with time, it also acquired a foothold among the Mithnagdic Lithuanian public. The biographies of famous Rashi Yeshivas are served up now as important spiritual food, enjoyed by young and old men and women. This, despite the uniformity which dominates these books, which are more or less the same in content and form, since the lives of Rashi Yeshiva are quite similar to each other, and few are the unique individualistic events that occur in their lives, and especially so when the historic and geographic eras are as relatively limited as is the Lithuanian Yeshiva world in the last generations. Against this background, we should view the appearance of Making of a Godel as a significant event. This book is not just another routine book in the series of Shivchei Tzadikim, praise of the Tzadikim of the Yeshiva world. The author of the book made a serious attempt and invested long and hard toil to describe the life chapters of Lithuanian Yeshiva personalities as they truly were, without rouge and mascara. It contains much light, the light of Torah and holiness, but also shadows of chulin and day-to-day living. As opposed to those who advocate literature of Shemen Zayizoch, pure olive oil, which has no weakness or failure, no mistake or slip-up, this author writes a history which does not filter out unpleasant details, a history into which entry is determined solely by one and only test, the test of truth, emes. This is how Professor Breuer's book review begins. And he is right. I followed in the tradition of two books authored about 75 years ago. One, a Hebrew book, Mekor Baruch, by Reb Baruch Epstein, author of Torah Tmima, and the other, a Yiddish book, Gdolim von unser Zeit, by Yaakov Mark, both published in the late 1920s. And like them, I wrote the truth as it was. And this is what bothered these zealots. in my father's house, I was raised from the youngest youth. The truth is the seal of God, the highest ideal man can reach. And without intending to do anything heroic, I wrote a book of truth. I naively believed that everyone would appreciate getting a true human glimpse at our spiritual leaders. But, obviously, the Zhilikas and their ilk refused to have the Gdolim pictured in their true identities as they truly were, about which we'll talk a bit more soon. I'll just add that when books will be written about Rav Eliashiv after 120 years, and an untruthful Shivchei Tzadikim volume will appear and state that Rav Eliashiv had Ruach HaKodesh, it will be a lie. Because he told me explicitly that he did not have Ruach HaKodesh, and he did not say it out of humility, but as an excuse for believing false stories that the Zhilikas told him. Now, I will mention another series of books on which a ban was issued quite recently. The books by Rabbi Nelson Slifkin, an expert in zoology and philosophy, who is nicknamed the Zoo Rabbi. His books pertain to science and Torah, and they have haskamas, some of which have been withdrawn. Now, the bans on both my book and Rabbi Slifkin's were issued for the world in Jerusalem. They're by following the prescript of the Navin, Yeshaya, and Micha, Ki Mitzia and Teisei Sora, Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. But I would like to read a line or two from one of the Osrim on Rabbi Slifkin's book, so that you may distinguish between that ban and the ban on my book. A Yeshiva World Authority in Jerusalem writes, he writes it here, as one who knows the English language, I can testify that a Talmud Chacham who is concerned about the honor of the Torah and the faith came before me and showed me books authored by one named Nelson Slifkin, which actually make the hair stand on end. From what I read therein, he believes that the world is millions of years old, earth to his mouth, feh, and such things that one is not permitted to hear and certainly to believe. I'm not going to discuss the essence of this critique. I only want to take note of two important differences between the ban on my book and this last, later ban on the Slifkin books. One difference is that Rabbi Slifkin was personally disparaged, but not I. My name was never mentioned in the Yisurim, only the name of my book. In fact, the Talmidim in Rav Eliashiv's daily shir asked him after he had issued the Yisur, after the ban was out, whether they should treat me with the same respect as before the ban. And he answered, absolutely yes. I answered the book, not the person. In fact, when I told Rav Eliashiv, this was a year ago in Elul, 2 days before he was taken suddenly to the hospital, if you recall, a surgeon was brought in from the United States to operate on him. 2 days before that, I met with him, and I told him that some people were turning down shidduchim with my grandchildren because of his ban. And I know that he didn't answer me, only answered the person. But obviously people understand the issue differently. So you know what he answered me? He said, I should tell the shadchanim, they should contact him, and he will recommend me. So there's one difference between the ban on Rabbi Slifkin's book and the ban on mine. The ban on Rabbi Slifkin's books was on the books and on the person. Whereas the ban on my book was only on the book, not on the person. And there is another difference. If you listen carefully to what that authority writes, In my, another difference, the one who signed the ban on Slifkin books, he writes, as one who knows the English language, I can testify. In other words, the one who signed the Genzer book actually read it. Whereas on my book, as I've been stating all along, the ones who signed just say we were shaken up to hear from reliable Torah scholars. But they did not read my book. This is another difference between the ban on the Slifkin books and the ban on my book. Now, there's one thing that I would like to point out in which both bans are the same. Of course, the ban on his book also has to do with heresy, not the same type of cause as the ban on my book. The Torah authority testified that the Slifkin book, as one who reads English, I can say that a Talmud Chacham who was concerned about the honor of the Torah and the faith came before him and showed him the Slifkin books. It is precisely the honor of the Torah and the faith that Slifkin set out to uphold. And that is what compelled him to write his books. And that's why he attempted to reconcile Torah and modern science. Because he wanted the honor of the faith should not, chas v'shalom, fall. And it is the Talmud Chacham who cannot accept Slifkin's attempts to reconcile Torah and science, and accepts blindly that the world is unquestionably only 5,765 years old. He is the one who is dishonoring the Torah and the faith in our modern day and age, but by not facing this problem. Likewise, in the case of my book, the ban of my book, those who claimed I was embarrassing the Gdolim of yore are the very ones who are embarrassing them by insinuating that if you say the truth about the Gdolim, it is an embarrassment for them. Aren't they saying that if you know the truth about those Gdolim, they will turn out to be non-Gdolim? This is what they are objecting to. I say if you say the truth about them, they become even greater. Because look at all the hardships they had. Look at all the nisyonos they had to overcome. They become even greater. But if they say this is an embarrassment, so what are they saying? They're saying that the Gdolim, if you know the truth about them, they're not really Gdolim. So who are the ones that are being mevazeh the Gdolim? The ones who are objecting to my book. The same as those who are dishonoring the Torah and the faith are the ones that are objecting to Slifkin's attempts. It is a case, both in mine and Rabbi Slifkin's, where we can apply the rule in the Gemara and Kedushin. Call not posel, b'muma posel. The fault that the detractor hurls at the other is the fault that the detractor himself is burdened with. In my eyes, both Isurim as such are not serious, despite all the aggravation, which I'll speak about soon. But in the essence of the ban itself is not serious. In the words that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach quoted from the Meiri, they are merely derech hagoas leitzim, the manner of the emendation of jokers. You know, every day of the year, we say a certain tefillah. We say a certain tefillah. Baruch Elokeinu Shebaanu Lichvodo, etc., etc. And we end, Leman lo nigalorik v'lo neileid labaholo. We pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we do not toil in vain and do not produce labaholo for aggravation, for disappointment. There is an objective prayer here and a subjective one. Objectively, we pray that something should result from our toil. Something important should come about from all the efforts, from all the work we put into something. When I wrote my book, after all my hard work, after 15 years of toiling, day and night,
And I have a witness here that I toiled day and night over it. My wife, my Rebbetzin, whose presence I acknowledge, is sitting right here. And she can also testify that I toiled day and night on this. And as I was toiling, I was uttering this prayer, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono Shel Olam. Number one, something should come out of it, something worthwhile, something historic, something that the world will appreciate 50 years from now, long after I'm gone. Something worthwhile. And I also prayed, Ribono Shel Olam, save me as the subjective tefillah, v'lo neled la behola. I should not produce something which will cause aggravation. Unfortunately, tefillah osa mechza, only half of my prayers were answered. It is a very important book, but a very aggravating one, and it's very sad. Thank you.